Blog Talk Radio.
Good evening, ladies and gentlemen. Welcome to Empire State Reptiles Live. I'm back and not feeling that well, but I'll make it through the show. I actually took a week-long vacation last week on the beautiful Norwegian cruise line. Norwegian Breakaway was the ship. So I'm back, and I got to see quite a few wildlife to where we actually went, our port of call. A lot of fish in Bermuda, beautiful fish. If you ever go to Bermuda, go snorkeling. Best experience of your life. So today, we do have Mr. Chris Leone from Garden State Tortoise. He has bred and kept over 50 species and subspecies of turtles and tortoises. I'm pretty sure you have heard of him, and if you haven't, you have been living under a rock for the past 20 years. So basically, I want to get out all of our announcements before the show because I feel we might have a high call volume. So as you guys know from our previous show, I talked about our back-to-school book bag giveaway, which will be taking place August 28th in Bed-Stuy, Brooklyn. Basically, if you know anyone or if yourself, if you have any type of family member, child, brother, sister, that is under the age of 18 and that attends an educational program for the 2016-2017 school semester, we are giving away 100 free book bags loaded with calculators, pencils, pens, books, composition notebooks. So anything that you can imagine, we want to give back to you guys who have helped us out the most in the process of getting our reptile show back. You guys all know our motto. We have been connecting breeders and fans since 2014. And as you know, we just came back from our year-long break, I guess you can call it. I'm using the air quotes there. So it's been just, again, really amazing. So we just wanted to give back as best as we can. And this was our way of giving back, of throwing a 100-bag book bag giveaway bash. So enough with all of that educational stuff, even though we're going to learn some stuff today. We want to have some fun. So today I'm going to officially welcome Mr. Chris onto our show. Good evening, Chris. How are you doing?
Hey, how are you?
I'm great. So I just want to jump right into it. So what do you do? I know you keep and you also breed turtles and tortoises. So how did that come to be?
Well, I was 5 years old playing in my sandbox with G.I. Joes. My dad was mowing the lawn. He hit a box turtle with the lawnmower. He just grazed it. He didn't hurt it really. And he gave it to me, and whatever happened that day, I don't know. You know, something changed, something blossomed, something exploded in my head, I don't know. But from that day forward, it was turtles, turtles, and more turtles. So fast forward 34 years, and here I am. My wife and I just completely dedicate our lives and our home to these animals. We are the official assurance facility for the turtle room. So there's a lot of different breeding projects going on here, ones that we started ourselves, ones that the Turtle Room started, some projects from the Turtle Survival Alliance and other organizations. We work hand in hand with all the local zoos in this state, fish and wildlife agencies, educational organizations, and we kind of consider ourselves our own educational organization because we, you know, first and foremost believe in educating the public about these animals, their importance on the planet, in nature, mm-hmm. and in captivity, and just kind of bridging the gap between conservation and the private sector.
Wow. So you just touched base on the turtle room. So what is the turtle room? Is it a rehabilitation center for turtles, or what is it?
It's basically a little bit of everything. It was founded by Steve Enders and Anthony Pierleone. Just two complete turtle nuts, just like ourselves. And it's an organization based on education, conservation, and survival of the world's turtles and tortoises. And it was started 5 years ago, or just over 5 years ago, and it just took off. You know, it's just been an amazing ride. I started off as an educational partner or resource partner for them, supplying care sheets, profiles, species profiles. And then, you know, one thing led to another and the organization grew and I grew with them. So they officially named me Director of Animal Husbandry, and our facility here in New Jersey is now the, you know, like I said before, the official assurance facility for the animals. It's not the only place that turtle room animals are kept. We have several locations throughout the country, but this is the main, you know, breeding facility, if you will. And the mission of the turtle room is to advance the survival of the world's turtles and tortoises through collaborative education, conservation, and research programs. So it basically means that we just have our hands in a little bit of everything. We're very active in the community, both in the field and from a corporate standpoint to an extent. You know, we several of us flew out to Louisiana 2 weeks ago to be part of the annual symposium for the Turtle Survival Alliance. Last year it was in Arizona, this year it's in New Orleans. So we were out there doing talks, you know, meeting and hanging out with, you know, some of the most famous people in herpetology. And, you know, that's just a little taste of what we do, you know, but first and foremost, you know, is educating people about the survival and the importance of the survival of these animals, because today turtles and tortoises are literally the planet's most endangered group of vertebrates.
Okay. So how do you feel when a person buys, let's say, a red ear slider? As you know, red ear sliders are one of the most popular turtles that are sold in pet stores. And you walk into any pet store and there are red ear sliders. Now, red ear sliders are also, like I said before, they're mostly bought by children. Parents buy them for their children, and they really don't know the care and everything that goes into the turtles and the dedication that they must put in. So how do you feel when you see, let's say, a 5-year-old child with a red ear slider?
First and foremost, you know, I don't feel that children should be deprived of anything. I feel that, you know, for lack of a better way of saying it, getting down and dirty and being one with nature right in your own backyard is something that's very important from the get-go. It's something that I'm going to show our children. And, you know, so in that sense, you know, it's important. It's important that kids know. And a lot of what we do is teaching kids, you know, how to help a turtle across the road, why you should leave them alone in the wild, and why certain ones should be kept in captivity and other ones shouldn't. Red-eared sliders is just an entirely different thing. It's a phenomenon because it just exploded. Yeah. And it exploded because of human activity. And my biggest problem is the lion, you know, still to this day. You know, Steve and I will be at a reptile expo trying to educate people and supplying people with legitimately captive bred animals that do well in captivity and that don't end up in shelters. And you've got the guy next to us lying to, like you said, a kid old enough to be at the show, saying that the turtle's going to grow as big as the tank. And that's why our facility ends up with 160 of them. You know, we have countless red-eared sliders here in a rescue pond. We take in everything we can from the state. We don't take them anymore from just, you know, someone can't call us or contact us through the website anymore saying, hey, I want you to take my red-eared slider because it got too big. We don't do that anymore. We can't anymore. We're now working with the state Fish and Wildlife Agency and the zoos to accept the red-eared sliders through them, but we're not taking them from just people that give up on them anymore because it's you said, it's a lifetime commitment. It takes a lot of dedication, and it's getting to the point where red-eared sliders are destroying native turtle populations because they're invasive in the majority of the United States at this point. You know, they're an invasive species in New Jersey, and, you know, the state is very concerned with it, as are we, because they are competing with native turtle populations. Like, for argument's sake, spotted turtles, you know, they're being wiped out in certain populations because of red-eared sliders. They've already taken hits because of human encroachment, illegal poaching, and habitat loss. And now with the red-eared sliders that are able to live in anything and eat just about anything, you know, a turtle that only grows to be 4 inches, like an American spotted turtle, doesn't even stand a chance. So, and, you know, I do feel that regulations need to be put in place on red-eared sliders because there seems to be another way to stop it. It's a shame because some of the regulations regarding reptiles in general are already too invasive, you know, in my opinion. But something like red-eared sliders is becoming a serious problem, okay? You've got sulcata tortoises that are another big problem. But the difference between those two is the sulcata is not going to survive, you know, in the northern regions of the United States once winter comes. It's going to eventually die, which is sad enough in itself for the animal and inhumane. But red-eared sliders don't die. They survive, and they breed, and they continue to procreate.
I have a question for you.
I'm sorry?
So do you feel that the answer to regulating, almost regulating from the, let's say, how should I put this? Regulating from the industry's point of view is raising the price of red-eared sliders. Do you feel that that would almost kind of self-regulate itself? Because if you look at a sulcata and you compare it to the price of a red-eared slider, there it's like nearly double the price, if triple the price.
Mm-hmm. I do feel that raising the price of them is something that could deter people, because you're right. Somebody, a young kid walking around a reptile show with his allowance, he's got $20 to spend. He could buy, you know, 4 red ears with that price, with that money. So, you know, it making them a little bit harder to obtain is definitely one way to do it, you know, because more expensive animals are not purchased as often. And when they are, they're less likely to end up in situations like ASPCAs or zoos or rescue centers, rehabilitation centers, or our facility. You know, like I said, 160 in the last 2 years we've taken in. And, you know, but part of the thing too is, and it's getting people on board to share the same opinion and act the same. So you've got to get all these dealers, all these people to agree to, okay, hey, you know, a baby red-eared slider is going to be $50 now. It's not a $5 turtle anymore. And we're not going to lie anymore. We're going to tell people, hey, this turtle is going to get huge. You know, at least the females are, and it's going to need this, that, and the other thing. And it's going to live a really long time. And so, but you know, it comes down to human trust. Like who can we and who can we not trust? And we run into that problem with any line of work or any industry. You know, you've got the people that will abide and will do what is necessary. And then you've got the other people that don't care and that will still continue to throw $5 baby red-eared sliders out onto their table and lie to kids about how big they're going to get and not care, you know, that half of them are probably going to die anyway. That does bring up a good, your thought is definitely valid in a sense where that could help, but it's a matter of getting everybody on board. You know, I mean, these guys are buying, you know, 1,000 baby red-eared sliders from these wholesalers and dealers for, you know, 50 cents or less. So they just throw them out on their tables for $5 or $10 or, you know, 2 for $7.50 or, you know, whatever. But it's a problem. It really is.
Yeah. So everyone knows, for all our new listeners, we do have a new guest call-in. It is 713-955-0793. So if you're interested in asking Chris a question, not me. Well, you can ask me a question, but not sure how I'm going to answer it. But if you're interested in asking Mr. Chris Leone a question, it's once again 713-955-0793. Now, Chris, I just wanted to ask you, still on that topic of the red-eared sliders, are they like the bunnies of the turtle world? Do they reproduce quickly? Or
yeah, they do. Like the bunnies? You know, clutches. You know, they do. You know, people will just keep a pair in a fish tank, and the next minute they're finding eggs. And they do. They can lay multiple clutches in a year. Some of the clutches are large. You know, I think some people get, you know, upwards of 12 or more eggs in a single clutch. And, you know, the babies hatch relatively fast, and they grow relatively fast. You know, people are breeding red ears in just a few years, you know, and that goes for the morphs, too. You know, a lot of people are working with these albinos and caramel pinks and whatever they're calling them these days, you know. And one of the most appealing things about the red ear to these, you know, morph collectors is the fact that they can make things happen quickly with them, whereas opposed to something like a North American wood turtle takes 12 to 17 years to mature. So you're not getting anything from them for more than a decade, usually, you know. So they are. That's a good way of putting it. They are kind of the bunnies. You know, there are other, you know, surprisingly productive species, you know, but red ears are definitely, you know, there's a lot of factors as to why they're so common.
Yeah. Okay, so it's my understanding that you have the largest collection of Western Hermann's tortoises in the United States.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, so
it's true.
What is that all about? Wow. So how many?
The Western Hermann's tortoise is a very rare Mediterranean tortoise, not to be confused with the common Eastern Hermann's that we see in, you know, reptile shows and on reptile dealer websites. They are two completely different entities, pretty much. They've tried to elevate them to full species level in the past, which was tentatively rejected. But what that means is they will no longer be referred to as the Eastern Hermann's tortoise and the Western Hermann's tortoise. They would be elevated to full species rank and be separated namely also. So the Eastern tortoise would be called Boettger's tortoise, and the Western would be called the Italian tortoise. Even though it occurs in other countries, its main location is Italy. So that being said, those are all that's the beginning of understanding what the differences are between them. Western Hermanns are very rare in nature and in captivity. They are considered one of, if not the most endangered reptile in Western Europe. They're IUCN, wow, red listed as endangered. And it's something that, you know, similar to the story I was telling you before when I was 5 years old and my dad found a box turtle, you know, for those first few years of being interested in turtles, all I knew was red eared sliders and neighborhood box and painted turtles. That's all I knew, you know. And then, you know, when my parents would get me books on turtles, I would start to see that there's a whole world of other species out there. But then in 1991, I was only 9 years old, my grandmother came home from Italy with a little baby Western Hermann's tortoise. And, you know, back then, they didn't have all these crazy laws that you couldn't do this, that, and the other. You know, the people on the plane and customs actually helped her to make sure that the tortoise was safe on the trip. And that just, again, changed me. I was like, what is this, you know? And so from that day forward, I became infatuated with tortoises, mainly Mediterranean species, and even more specifically, the Western Hermanns. And unfortunately, because I didn't know anything back then, the tortoise barely made it a year, and it ended up dying on me because I wasn't caring for it properly. And that again changed me, and I felt horrible and swore I would never let this happen again, and I wanted to do as much research as I could. So it took me almost another about 13 more years after that to finally start getting in touch with people that had them. And at the time, there was only one gentleman in the U.S. that had them. He had brought them over himself in the 1970s. He just had a small group of them, and I befriended him. He's probably going to want to stay unnamed, so I'm not going to say his name. But he may not care, but, you know, I don't want people hounding him. So anyway, I befriended him, and I told him, if you ever wanted to get rid of these, please, you know, I'm your guy. I will keep them pure. I will do right by them. Yeah. And he kept his word. When he finally decided to get out of the hobby, he let me have those adults. And that just started, you know, blossoming even further. And over the course of the next few years, I started breeding that small group and getting in touch with overseas parties, you know, ministries and researchers and representatives in Italy and Spain. And through basically years of unbelievable patience, paperwork, approvals from the ministries and our United States Fish and Wildlife Service, I was able to bring in legally several distinct locales of Western Hermanns. Because right now the Western Hermanns is considered one thing, but they're broken down by different locales, which, you know, it's the same thing with snakes and other herps, you know. Ones from here look different than these. So, and I believe heavily in that because nature put this one here and put that one there. So I like to keep it that way. So I brought them over, and, you know, Steve and I from the Turtle Room, we knew we had something big on our hands, and we had to do something more because this was something that had never been in the United States before. So we created the North American Regional Stud Book for them as a way to monitor them, because we knew, okay, we have the adults here at our facility and we're breeding them, but now that the offspring are going to start going out to other serious parties, you know, for them to experience them themselves, for the hobby. It's something new that nobody's really had before. And for assurance reasons, you know, you want other people to have these animals, because what if something were to happen here, you know, God forbid.
Yeah.
So the stud book enables us to really closely monitor the animals, know where they're going, who's being born, who unfortunately may die, who's being transferred where, what pairings we're doing for genetic variability. And for the most part, it's been an amazing experience. The animals are doing phenomenal. They've already been genetically tested to back up the purity on them. But, you know, of course, we have some people in the book that we're going to probably have to get rid of, unfortunately, because they're not following the rules and not doing well by the animals. But for the most part, it's been an incredible experience.
Okay. So normally I want to gauge this question from everybody that I do have on the show. Do you actually have a prized possession animal-wise? Well, not possession. I wouldn't call them a possession, but a prized animal that you would kill for, basically, that you keep under close surveillance, I guess you could say, but you kind of love them more than the other animals, even though it's not technically right, but you do.
First of all, you know, I'll kill for any of these things. You know, it's everything is on lockdown here. Everything is under full surveillance and protected to the nines. You know, that's never a concern for us, thankfully. But as far as like quote unquote favorites, you know, there are animals throughout my life that, you know, just really, you're right, like they just stand out above the rest. They're like all stars for whatever reason. And one animal who's unfortunately no longer with us was one of the very first, she was actually the very first adult Western Hermans that I ever got, that I got from that gentleman I was describing to you before. He was the only one in the country with them at the time. And she was just, you know, just looks wise right off the bat, personality. She's just an incredible animal. And her name was Bumblebee. And, I had her here's what's cool about her. When he brought her in the 1970s, she was an old adult then. Okay. Full grown, old, bowling ball smooth. She didn't even have any like growth rings on her anymore. That's how you can tell a tortoise is old.
Wow.
Yeah. In the 70s. And I didn't get her until 2004, I think. And she just died, in August of 2014. She started having seizures. I don't know why, you know, we didn't have enough time to get her to my vet. She just started having them and was dead by that night. You know, they say, some people say that turtles and tortoises can't technically die of old age. I think maybe that's what it was. But she was just, she was like an icon for me, you know, earlier in my career, like people knew that tortoise cause I would always talk about her and people would say, oh, how's Bumblebee? You know? And I always took photos of her and she was like really my favorite animal. And so when she died, you know, like nobody's ever filled that gap, you know, my entire Western Hermans collection is really my prize. You know, I mean, it's just something that if God forbid something happened to them, there's nothing to replace them with, you know. But there's other animals in the collection. We have a Blanding's turtle named Indy. He's the male in our breeding group that we've had forever. It's usually things that have a name that, you know, there's something about them that, you know, made them stand out. He's been with me for 12 years now. And, you know, he's even though he's part of our breeding group, he's like a pet, you know, and there's other animals, you know, my wife is raising an Aldabra and a Galapagos tortoise. And those are like her children, you know, even though we're about to have a child, those are like her children for now. You know, there's always those animals, you know, I could probably name somebody in every group that just stands out above the rest.
Oh, wow. So, just actually one thing. How do you live? Well, you do live. You live in New Jersey, and New Jersey is obviously on the East Coast of the United States. So weather is not that great all the time. So how do you deal with that, especially having, I'm guessing, a couple of stops?
You know, New Jersey is a land of extremes. You know, in my opinion, I've been all over the U.S. There is no place in the U.S. that has a summer like New Jersey. New Jersey summers are just if I lived in another state, I would come to New Jersey for summer just because the summers here are great. They're so classic. You know, they're hot. They get humid at times. You get those raging thunderstorms. It's great for the beach, you know. But winter is awful and spring is even worse. Spring is the worst season in New Jersey by far, because Mother Nature just can't decide what she wants to do. One day she wants to be 50, then she wants to be 80, then she wants to throw some snow at you, then she wants to melt it all. It's like, it's a headache. So species that hibernate are easy, you know. Species that don't hibernate, you know, we have to bring them indoors in the winter. And luckily we have a huge basement that spans the entire house, and it's also unfinished, so we can get as dirty as we want down there. So, you know, everything comes in and is safe and monitored closely over the winter. And, you know, winter in a sense is not a bad thing because it's good for certain species that need the hibernation. And it's also good for us. It gives us a little break from certain species, you know, like going back to the Blandings turtles, they're a very expensive group of turtles to maintain. You know, they eat a lot more than most species. They lose weight faster than other species, and it costs a lot to feed them. So when they go to sleep in October and don't wake up until April, it's nice. You know, it's like, okay, see you later, you know, for a little while. But we make do. And, you know, unfortunately, it's spring and winter are no fun, but summer and fall are great. You know, fall is beautiful and mild. This past year, winter was a joke. I was wearing shorts on Christmas Eve. It was so warm.
Wow.
Yeah, but and it was pretty much like that almost, you know, all winter long. It would get real cold and then warm up, real cold and warm up. And then spring came and spring was colder than the entire winter pretty much. So it's weird here, you know. But this is where I've lived my whole life. Same thing with my wife. We're just used to it. We know how to make do. And even the two main guys from the Turtle Room, Anthony and Steve, they're in the Northeast also, Pennsylvania and Connecticut. So we just know how to do it. It's kind of effortless for us at this point.
Okay. So don't forget, guys, you can call in at 713-955-0793. Once again, that is 713-955-0793. Now, you do obviously have a lot of tortoises and turtles. So how do you maintain a good, clean collection as far as disease control and parasite control?
It's a 24/7 job, so always with the animals, you know, night and day. Everybody's monitored, everybody's housed separately. For the most part, every single species is maintained separately, and there's no chance of cross-contamination. The species that do occur together or live together are ones that do occur together in the wild. So, for instance, in our wood turtle pen, there's also eastern box turtles. In our Blandings turtle pen, there's also eastern box turtles because they occur together, you know, in nature. So there's no problem there. But, everything else is maintained by species, by subspecies, or even as far down to as locale. You know, none of the Western Hermans locales can get to each other. They're completely separated.
Yeah.
It's a matter of, you know, just hygiene. You know, you got to wash your hands. You don't go walking into pens with the shoes that you just came out of another one with. You know, maybe take your shoes off or something. And it becomes effortless after a while. The parasite thing is, I think, something that is very sorely misunderstood in the reptile community. Reptiles have to have parasites. You know, they have to have a healthy load of beneficial bacteria in there. A lot of these parasites that show up on fecal exams are what they're supposed to have. You know, the practice of completely worming a reptile and getting rid of everything in their gut is actually bad for them. And, you know, people panic when they get a fecal done and they see some parasites in there. They think the animal's sick and going to die. But as long as it's a healthy load, it needs to be left alone. So a lot of our species here, they live kind of wild, you know. Obviously, we maintain them and we feed them, but they do find their own food. They do what they kind of want to do, and that's how we want them to be. We want them to behave in a natural way. Nobody gets sick. Nobody comes down with unhealthy parasitic loads because they're comfortable. They're not stressing out. They're able to exhibit normal behavior.
All right. So I just wanted to touch base on something that it's kind of different. We've seen two-headed animals before, but very rarely do you see conjoined animals that are actually together, that hatched out together. And I know you actually had a case of that not too long ago. Was it like 1 or 2 years ago?
It'll be 1 year this October.
Oh, wow. So basically, what happened?
We hatched twin Western Hermans tortoises out of the same egg. They were conjoined by the yolk sac, and they weren't shown. Really, how it started was this clutch of eggs was done hatching, and there was still one egg left that was past due. And you know, I don't like to break an egg open, but at a certain point in time, you have to find out what's going on. So I was actually starting to prepare myself to crack this egg open just to see if maybe the baby was having trouble. So as I went to do that, I noticed that it was pipping. You could see the head of the tortoise coming out of the egg a little bit. I was like, okay, it's fine. It's just taking a while. The next day I go in there, the thing is still the same. The next day I go in there, and it's still the same. It's not trying to get out. So I'm like, all right, I have to intervene here. So I started peeling the eggshell back, and sure enough, there was another one in there. And that's why this one couldn't get out, is because it was stuck. So I pulled them out, and they were both fully formed and very much alive, one much smaller than the other. But 9 times out of 10, when there are twins, one is either dead or very underdeveloped, and that wasn't the case with these. Mm-hmm. So we knew we had to step in and do something. So I had heard something from somewhere a long time ago. I couldn't even tell you who. I wish I could give them credit, but I don't remember how I heard this, that using dental floss would be a good way to separate them. So what I did was, and then you could see the whole video on YouTube because we wanted to show people how to do it in case they were to come across this situation themselves. And we tied either end off, and then we tied another one in the middle a little bit tighter, and we let them separate themselves. So over the course of the next few days, they slowly finally separated. The dental floss fell off, and they absorbed their yolk sac, and they have thrived ever since. You know, their one is still a little bit smaller, but they are hard-shelled now. They're developing it just like any other sibling would or any other tortoise. And, you know, there's just no complaints. They're just doing wonderful. And for whatever reason, that video just went viral more than I never imagined it. I made that video on my I made that video on my iPhone just to throw it out there because I like to do educational pieces because that's what we're all about. And the next minute, it just, 10,000 views, 10,000 more views. It just kept going up and up and up. And then Fox News is contacting us, CNN, BTC Earth, whoever, all these different entities. And then BBC Earth. And then, before we knew it, boom, it surpassed 1 million views. I don't even know where it is right now. It's probably at like 1 million and a half views. Yeah, it's just, and these two little tortoises are just like, famous, and everybody wants to see them. When people come here, sometimes occasionally we allow visitors, but it's not a public facility by any means. And people want to take photos with them and hold them, and it's just, they're just a success story. That's really what it is that, because we intervened, they lived. And, there's no masochism about that. We had to do something because the one couldn't even get out of the egg. And because we did it, they're both alive and just doing absolutely incredibly. And, they're not identical either. They look very different. One actually has extra scutes. The other one has normal scutes. Their markings are different. And we named them after the two original Western Hermans that I first got. One is Bumblebee and the other one is Yellowjacket. And those were, we're kind of just like reliving the memory of those original two by these two because they're so special. And it's cool because there was somebody else down in Florida that hatched twins, and they were able to use that method, so it's pretty cool, to see other people being able to do it. And, there have been twins in the past too. I wasn't the first one to do it, just these two, I just struck a nerve with people and touched, warmed hearts, I guess. And it was really cool. It really, really opened up doors to people knowing who we are and what we're doing. And it's just been nothing but a positive response. It's really incredible.
All right. So, as you know, a lot of people are interested in keeping turtles and tortoises and pets.
Mm-hmm.
There are obviously people out there. Most of the people out there do have good intentions, but some of them do not, I wouldn't say qualify, but use that word, but they don't have the proper knowledge to actually care for the animal. So, let me ask you something. What is the biggest myth out there about keeping turtles and tortoises?
That's a really good question. The biggest myth, I would say, probably the salmonella thing. The turtles carry salmonella. Yes, they absolutely can. Are you going to get it? If you're not, how do I say this nicely? you're not going to get it if you're careful. You're not going to get it if you're a smart human being. You know what I mean? Like, sure, accidents can happen, but, salmonella is really only a major threat in young children. And sadly, this law regarding turtles under 4 inches was set in motion because of bad parenting. You should be watching your child. You shouldn't just let him run around with any wild or live animal by himself or by him or herself. And what happened was, these kids are putting turtles in their mouths, and then of course you're going to get it. Of course you're going to get something, Go outside right now and put a toad in your mouth, you're probably going to get sick, So it was, it was enacted because of bad parenting, which is really a shame. The parents should have been the one paying the price and not, people who are doing right by these animals. So that's probably the biggest myth with it is it's nowhere near the threat that people think it is. And it's a shame when you see the surfacing of salmonella always being blamed on turtles, because I got news for everybody. You might as well outlaw chickens then, because that's really where it comes from, you know?
Yeah.
So that's the biggest myth. The other myth is, let me think. Probably one of the biggest myths is that all turtles need full spectrum lighting. You know, I think that's something that really hasn't surfaced yet. It's something that should. It's actually not necessary to several species. A lot of the Asian species do not require any lighting at all, and they actually stress out from it. A lot of your common basking turtles, of course, do need it. You know, red-eared sliders absolutely need it, which is something that should be told to these kids when they're going to buy them, because they think they can just throw it in a 10-gallon tank and call it a day. Probably one of the other things is, you know, the legalities involved in it. People love to say that turtles are illegal in New Jersey. Let me be the first to tell everybody out there that if turtles were illegal in New Jersey, I'd be talking to you from prison right now, you know, because I would have been put in jail a long time ago. Turtles are very, very legal in New Jersey. You just have to have paperwork, and you have to get a permit, and you just can't sell them within the state lines. So, you know, if you lived in New Jersey, I can't sell a turtle to you, you know. That's the only thing.
Oh.
You know, so I mean, but there's a lot of myths out there, but I think the biggest one is probably the salmonella thing. Is it's just nowhere near the scare that the media talks it up to be. They just, you know, they're just looking for something to sell, someone to blame, you know.
All right, so I think we actually have a caller on the line. Let's go to line one. 781, you're on the line. Hello? Just hung up. So if you're ready to talk, you can just give me a call back, 713-955-0793. I'm not sure why our call, that call just dropped. No, okay. It's thundering outside right now, so yeah. Anyways, what else was I going to ask you before? It's really interrupted. Oh, yeah. What do you feel is the best? Actually, let me ask this question first. Have you? I know you've probably heard of the Zoomed tortoise enclosure that are sold a lot at the reptile expos that I attend and most people attend. It's basically like a wooden enclosure for all of you that don't know.
Yep.
It's a wooden enclosure meant for tortoises, basically. Just meant for tortoises. Now, a lot of people do start off with them, and I've recently saw somebody with a how many inches was it? I think it was like almost like a 10-inch tortoise in the tortoise enclosure, and now I was kind of worried about that.
So,
what do you feel is the best enclosure to
enclosure? The best enclosure for a hatchling of any species is just going to be a Rubbermaid container from Walmart. And the reason for that is, now, I love Zoomed. I think Zoomed's a great company. They sponsor a lot of amazing things. They make great products. But the tortoise house enclosure is not acceptable for hatchlings. And the reason for that is because hatchlings need a very high degree of humidity or deep, wet, moist, not wet, moist substrate to burrow into. For many years, everybody thought that the pyramiding of the shell was caused by protein or an improper diet. We now know that that is not true. And it's basically mainly caused by lack of humidity and hydration. And this is because when tortoises are babies, they all congregate in moist, dark areas, especially at night. And they subject themselves to a microclimate that's very high in humidity. And if you notice, in the wild, they grow almost always smooth. Or even when they do have a little bit of pyramiding, it's just minimal in the wild. In captivity, tortoises are becoming extremely deformed. They don't even look anything like what they're supposed to look like. Sometimes it's even hard to identify them because not only are they deformed, but their color is gone. So it's important, like the best thing you could do for a baby tortoise is just go out to Walmart and spend $10 and just get yourself a Rubbermaid container, fill it with the appropriate moist substrate at a reasonable depth so that the tortoise can burrow whenever it wants. And then once it comes out of that fragile stage and it's a couple inches now, like usually the cutoff is about 4 inches, now it's substantial, it's less vulnerable, it's now put on most of its early growth so that it's now smooth. Now you can move it into something a little bit more aesthetically pleasing, like the tortoise house, because it is a beautiful enclosure. But the problem with that is it's wooden, so you can't put moist substrate in it, and it doesn't hold humidity, again, because it's wooden and it has a screen top. So, you know, the best beginning thing for any species across the board is going to be a Rubbermaid container of some sort, something that's rubber or plastic that can hold the moisture, you know. And what I even do for when they're babies is I like to put the lid on at night so that the humidity really builds up in there, and then in the morning it releases, just like it would in nature. When the sun comes out in the morning, it dries everything up. So, you know, is the Zoomed tortoise house a good enclosure for you know, smaller species? You can't have 10-inch animal in there. Absolutely, but you don't want to use it for a hatchling. Hello? 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 Are we still there? Well, I'm not sure if anybody can hear me, but I can't hear anything. What? Hello? Hello, hello, hello. Anybody there?